Latin America, right, and the Inca countries experienced just massive cycles, escalating cycles of mobilization, right? And they were able to do so precisely because they had achieved high levels of organizational capacity. Right? They had amassed over years of resistance, organizing resources, which they put to good use, right, and accomplished quite a bit. But what they were lacking, right, in comparison to the classical the classical left in Latin America, were constituencies rooted in structural positions that gave these movements leverage. So rather than to look at the Pink Tide and kind of dismiss the Pink Tide government, saying, oh, they were just, you know, they were sellouts, they were too timid, right? They were just there essentially to restore, a lot of claims are made that they were just there to restore neoliberal legitimacy, right? I thought it was more worthwhile to actually get a firmer grasp on their actual capacity, the capacity of these governments to push further. And since they had inherited growth model, the neoliberal growth model, right? And they were supported by the results of this turn to neoliberalism, right? These informal sectors that, again, were highly organized. They didn't have the ability to push further and to push beyond a neoliberal growth model and place more radical reforms on the agenda. That's broadly the layout of both the analytical framework, but also the argument that I make in the analysis.
Okay, thanks. Well, it's nice to have an opportunity to be part of this panel and to comment on Renee's paper, because I think it's a paper that has a lot of insight and makes some very important contributions to our understanding of the, you know, whether you want to call it the pink tide or the left turn, people call it different things, but clearly the important political shifts that took place in Latin America at the end of the 1990s and then the first part of the 2000s. And I'll say I really like this paper a lot, and I think it is an important contribution. And I don't say that just to be polite. People always say that when you're commenting on papers, but I actually mean it very sincerely. I think one of the real weaknesses of much of the literature on the Pink Tide has been precisely the absence of a good structural understanding of what the Pink Tide was about, how the structural conditions, in other words, sort of the post-neoliberal logic of capitalism in Latin America, and how that shaped the social landscape and the class formation, the role of labor and other social actors in the political arena. And I think there's been much more attention in the literature given to the role of populist leaders or political parties, the choices that they make, the policies they adopt. There's been a lot of literature on those kinds of questions. There's been much less literature that really digs into the underlying social bases of these leftist projects in Latin America. So I've myself been thinking for quite some time that this is something we need. I've been telling myself for years I should write something on this myself, and I haven't gotten around to it. So I applaud you for doing that, and I mean that quite sincerely. I think this is a very important piece. Panels are never very interesting if you just praise the work. So what I'm going to do, and rather than sort of give a long comment, what I thought I would do is try to package a couple of questions that I can pose to Renee, and then I've got another set of questions. So I'll just say a few words, and then I'll let him respond, and then I'll have a few more words that I want to say. The first set of questions has to do with, how do we measure the success of the different lefts? And I like your distinction between the classical left and the new left of the Pink Tide. I think it's very important to have those kinds of comparative insights. And it's very clear, as you talk about in the paper and explain quite well, that the new left in Latin America, whether you want to call it more moderate, less ambitious, more cautious, you know, clearly compared to the classical left, which really had socialist agendas or certainly deeper, reformist and transformative visions of what they wanted to do for the kinds of social and economic changes they wanted to make. And so the Pink Tide left, for the most part, has been pretty cautious. And you provide a very important explanation for why that is. But I'm curious, how would you characterize the success of these two different lefts. Because when I look back at the classical left in Latin America, it's true that they were very ambitious, but they also were not very successful. They had a couple of places, depending on who you count. If you count Cuba, obviously they came to power through revolution. Nicaragua, they also came to power through an armed revolution. But where the classical left needed or had to participate within democratic arenas, they were not very successful at all. They really only came to power in Chile for 3 years, and maybe you would count Brazil for a couple of years before the coups. In both cases, they were not able to complete a single presidential term in office before they were destroyed by a combination of elite and military backlashes. Elsewhere in the region, they relied upon the military. In Peru, you sort of had a radical left, but it was under a military regime, and you had leftist currents within Peronism, but Peronism was never a leftist party. And so ultimately, I would argue that the classical left, although it certainly had very ambitious transformative agendas, it was not very successful in arriving to power. And when it was successful and it tried to implement those transformative agendas, it was not politically viable. And the classic disaster, of course, would be the Chilean case under Allende with the coup in 1973. In contrast, in the pink tide, what is striking to me in historical terms has been, the resiliency. Not just that you had the left coming to power in a number of countries in the region, but they were reelected in virtually all of these cases. And all of the four cases you focus on in your paper, in Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Argentina, those are all leftist governments that were reelected multiple times and were in office for over a decade. In the Bolivian case and the Venezuelan case, they're both still in power, albeit under increasingly autocratic, measures in the Venezuelan case. But the Bolivian case is still looking pretty resilient in a lot of ways. So ultimately, the question then is to, how would you characterize, do the kinds of factors that you're talking about, do they impinge upon the relative success of the two different lefts? Is it that the pink tide left has been more successful in coming into power and then staying in office and governing for a longer period of time? Is that because they have moderated their position so much so that they're less of a threat to elite interests? Obviously, the commodity boom of the 2000s helped with the re-election in certain ways. But I'm curious as to how you would characterize the relative success or failure of the two different lefts. And then sort of the follow-up question to this is, do you see the failure of the pink tide? Is it, how much structural determination really is there? I mean, you're giving us a structural argument as an alternative to the more conventional voluntaristic or political agency focused kinds of explanations. And I'm very sympathetic to that. But the challenge with structuralist accounts is they can be very deterministic. And so I guess the question is, how much room for maneuver was there in the pink tide? Were there opportunities to dig deeper and to try to transform more aggressively than what they did, opportunities that they didn't take advantage of? So could they have done more than what they did? Or are the structural constraints so severe that, that they were very limited to the kinds of clientelistic sort of limited welfareist kinds of measures that you talk about, and that there really were no opportunities to try to pursue more aggressive kinds of change. So how deterministic really was it, and was there maneuvering space that they didn't take advantage of? So those are the first two main questions that I wanted to pose to you.
Okay, great questions. With respect to how to measure the success, right, between these two generations of the left in Latin America, I want to start off by saying that there's an obvious way which you point to in which the classical left failed, right? And I actually take this up in the article, and I want to say something about the failures before I get into the successes, if that's okay, because I think there's a lot that we can learn from where the defeats come from in both cases, right? So it's obvious that, as Kenneth just mentioned, the classical left failed in the sense that there are very few instances in which the actual radical left or the socialist left came to power. And when they did come to power. So, for instance, again, the best case is in Chile under Allende, when the Socialist Communist Coalition comes to power. They are defeated historically with the coup, right? And that ushers in what we all, I'm assuming most of you guys know the history, but it ushers in the kind of prelude to the neoliberal turn in Latin America. I think it's quite instructive to start with that, because the failures in that sense of the left, actually, of the classical left, reflect its strength in one respect, and how threatening it had actually become. And I'm not saying that's good enough. It's still a failure, of course. But it's interesting to take note of the fact that in many of the cases, even in instances, even in countries in which the left itself, left didn't come to power. So Argentina is another great case, right, under the Peronists, right? The labor movement and these social bases of the push for reform had become so threatening that elites felt compelled to step in and quash not only the movements and labor unions and political parties, but democracy itself, right? So it's the very fact that the violent defeat of the classical left, both when it came to power and when it pushed from outside, right, as in the Argentine case, the Brazilian case, for instance, right, came from elites themselves who felt they had to intervene in this forceful way. And I want to say something about how, you know, elites matter in a different sense later. If you can track that to what's happening in the Pink Tide, while it's true that the Pink Tide governments have been able to be reelected, and in the Bolivian case, they're actually doing quite well. And even, you know, even in cases like in Argentina and Ecuador, where they have lost elections, they managed to stay in power and implement some meaningful reforms, right? That seems to be a sign of efficacy and success. What's interesting, though, and I point this out in the article, is that in those cases, the defeats are actually coming in the electoral arena. And it's the very constituencies that brought them to power that are turning against them, right? That are voting them out of power, or simply not voting at all, right? As in, I think we can make that case, for instance, in Argentina. It's not that the Peronist base is actually turned on the Kirchners and supported Macri, right? It's that the Peronist party, the neo-Peronists, couldn't mobilize them for elections, and so they lost. In 2015. I think you see similar dynamics with the exception of Venezuela. Venezuela, as we can talk about, I think, as a separate case, it's become so complicated, right? Even though there, again, the Chavista bases are turning against Maduro, not actively. They're not supporting, obviously, efforts to topple him through a coup, but they're not coming out to support Chavismo as they used to. So I think the very fact that the Pink Tide is in decline is being defeated in a sense by its own constituencies also is a reflection of just how cautious, how moderate, right, the Pink Tide governments were, and this inability to push further, to push more for more transformative policies, right, that could have kept the whole process going and kept its electoral bases happy and mobilized in their support. That's one thing I want to point out before I get into how to actually measure success. There's a kind of weak way that I think avoids the question. There's a weak way to answer it. I'm going to go ahead and say something about it anyways. There's something to it. One way to measure or to, you know, think about what they were doing, what they were effective at doing, was actually putting radical reforms on the agenda, right? Again, this happened whether it was in the Chilean case where the UPE government, the Popular Unity government, actually legislated these reforms or tried to, right? Not only those cases though, but also in cases where the, you know, radical socialist left didn't come to power, as in Argentina, the left wing of the Peronist party, right, and the radicalization of sections of the labor movement that were still inside Peronism, right, were very successful at putting very radical reforms on the national policy agenda. These included nationalization of industry, worker control, right? Far more robust social provision and universal forms of social provision that, again, they didn't quite achieve because of the way that these movements and governments were defeated, but they managed to place them on the agenda. Okay, that's not success in and of itself, but the contrast with the Pink Tide, I think, is instructive, right? Where these types of radical demands were never quite placed on the agenda, right? There's a lot of talk about nationalizations in the Pink Tide governments. I mean, the best measurements of this, right, say that it's actually quite paltry. I mean, very little. Even in the Venezuelan case, it's very, very, it's been very weak. Right. If you move over to like social provision, also it's not, the Pink Tide governments didn't even attempt to move towards broader, more universal forms of coverage in terms of social policy and social supports. Right. So there's that, I think, which is worth mentioning. But I think the classical Pink Tide went beyond this. The classical left went beyond this, and here's where that longer looking backward, right, beginning in the 50s all the way up into the 70s and even the 80s in some countries, you could say that it was the classical left that actually was able to achieve some core reforms, right? One is in terms of just political democracy. I think it's the classical left is largely, from my perspective, I mean, I know there's debate around this, right? But not only for putting suffrage, universal suffrage, and real suffrage, right? Suffrage that included women, suffrage that included, I mean, the real right to vote for peasants, right? In Chile, peasants didn't have a fucking right to vote until the late 50s, early 60s, effectively speaking, right? And it's a huge chunk of the population, right? I would attribute those types of just core political reforms to the classical left, right? The article, you know, takes that detour into Central America, and I think in Central America, it's the most pronounced, right? Without the Central American insurgencies, you wouldn't have any democracy to speak of in Central America, you know, at least in the countries that I address. So there's that, the basic political reform, so democratizing the state, democratizing politics. But there's also a way in which, again, through, there were deeper forms of democratization that occurred, I think largely because of the demands and the mobilizations, the pressure by the classical left, in terms of socioeconomic democracy, right, and social rights. I've spoken some, you know, to some extent about that, but even where the left failed to achieve, like in the Chilean case, right, the full realization of its social program, right, they had already pushed for very robust forms of social coverage that I think were quite meaningful. The Argentine case, again, where it's the labor movement, it's not even before it radicalizes, right, it's the organized working class in industry, right, of course with support from above. We can't, and that's where I said there's some debate around this, right? Through these corporatist mechanisms. But it's largely the working class and the left within the organized labor movement and beyond, right? And as I said, peasant movements, etc., that is pushing for these types of socioeconomic democracy. So I would attribute those forms of success as well to the classical left. Those successes to the classical left. So if you take all that and you compare it to the Pink Tide, you know, it's true, the Pink Tide did manage to stay in power longer, right? Has been more resilient. So that kind of durability of the Pink Tide in power, right, says a lot. But what it couldn't do, right, even when it was in power, right, was to deepen these reforms or even place more radical reforms on the agenda. The other thing I haven't mentioned that the left did, I think, and the classical left did, right, was to not only place on the agenda, but to actually affect policy in terms of structural reform of the economy, structural transformations of the economy, where the efforts were aimed at going from ISI, so economic modernization that elites and the states, the non-left states, right, had been behind, and from within that program, right, trying to push for deeper structural transformation of the economy. So taking ISI, right, to a further step. And of course, again, back to the pink debt, not even anywhere under consideration from my perspective. Now, you might say that the initial fairly ambitious reforms in the oil sector in Venezuela, gas in Bolivia, right, might be construed as such, as more meaningful reforms. Actually, they're even those moves, those measures were pretty timid, right? It involved just redistributing rents, right, in a good way, obviously, and this financed a lot of the social programs. But in no way did it actually place structural reform of how the industry was financed, how it would operate, how it was run, whether it be run democratically. Didn't put any of that on the agenda. So that's what I would say in terms of how to think of success. Again, with that, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that, you know, there were serial failures in that. There were serial military interventions which quashed these movements and left parties and even non-left parties, right, and ended democracy. About my the structural approach of my analysis, right? Kenneth hit it right on the head. This is exactly what I was trying to do. Move away from analyses that just said, "Oh, these politicians, right? They don't have the right politics, or they're too soft, right? Or this is what I describe as a voluntarist approach to an assessment of the left, of the pink tide left." I was definitely trying to get away from that and look a bit deeper, right, to see what the actual possibilities for pushing further were. And that's, of course, where the structural approach comes in. Is it too deterministic, right? Does it miss a lot? Does it, in particular, miss cases in which there might have been more room for maneuver, right? And in strictly looking at, right, these structural measures, and, you know, looking at, for instance, the percentage of labor that worked in industry, the percentage that's, you know, informally employed, etc., does that place certain blinders on me and miss a lot of what's going on? I think, you know, yes and no, in one respect. I think, obviously, what I was trying to do with the article was not to give, right, an in-depth account of everything that's going on and on a case-by-case basis. I hope to be able to expand it into something that does more of that. I was looking at, obviously, basic, broad trends that we could look at to try to establish at least some parameters, right? Some basic limitations that the pink tide, right, suffered when compared to the classical left. Now, does that mean that once I look at these variables, once I look at these factors, I say, well, that's it, that determined everything? No, I think of course there was variation from case to case, and I point to some of the variation, not enough as I should have, just didn't have room. But obviously, what happened in Venezuela is not the same as what happened in Ecuador. What happened in Bolivia is not the same as what happened in Argentina. But the fact of the matter is that across all four cases, and we can say perhaps some more later on why I think those are the four cases to look at when thinking of the pink tide. Fact of the matter is that across all four cases, the outcomes themselves were quite similar, right? Now, I guess you could argue that in each case, there were opportunities, and they were missed. And if had they, you know, had the politics of the Pingtai countries been a bit different, had they, you know, taken advantage of certain opportunities a bit differently, then the outcomes would have been more varied, right? And I think it's worth, you know, we should do that. We should do that type of analysis. A lot of people have, but my point was that the structural weaknesses of all the, you know, the social bases of the Pingtai governments, right, say something. They do place certain, you know, real constraints on what they were able to do. Now, beyond that, we should look at how much variation there actually was and how much variation there might have been. My one thing to, I think, consider that is, you know, I feel commonality across all cases, right, was this shift toward new forms of clientelism, right? And I asked in the article, why is it that they all chose this route? And my view of it is not just that, again, they were really, you know, wolves in sheep's clothing, they were, you know, disguised neoliberals, right? Or that they were under such intense business pressure, which they were. And I think that's a big gap in my article, right? Of course there was business resistance. But it's that actually, given their options, this was the easiest way to stay in power. Right? They're not being pressured from below for deeper change, right? They want to win elections, right? They have these massive rents from the commodity boom, right? They have certain demands by, you know, the organized informal sectors placed on them. So the easiest thing to do to stay in power was to redistribute these rents in, you know, these neo-corporatist clientelist networks that they set up. Once again, that commonality, I think, can largely be explained by you know, the structural weaknesses of their constituents. Not to say that there wasn't a lot of variation and room for more variation, but I do think it placed sharp limits on their ability to move further.
Okay. So if I could follow up with another couple of questions related to the cases that you're looking at and why you decide to focus on this set of cases, given that, you know, many people would argue that there were other cases within Latin America that also elected leftist governments in this time period. And so you're focusing on Venezuela, you know, sort of the Bolivarian cases, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and then also Argentina, all of which were cases where there was some sort of popular uprising, mass social movements that helped to bring down the traditional party systems and open the door for some sort of new alternative of the left to emerge. Argentina is a little bit different because it, you know, it emerges within the Peronist party, but it's sort of a, you know, a strengthening of the leftist current within Peronism. So those cases, you know, you're defining the left term basically in terms of that particular pathway of bringing the left to power. The question that is, what about the other countries in Latin America that also elected political parties of the left, certainly parties that define themselves as being on the left and are generally, you know, considered to be left of center political parties, in most cases more institutional and more long-standing institutionalized parties of the left, that came to power in context where party systems don't collapse, but they were elected into office and then tried to govern within the constraints of the institutions that were in place. And so, you know, you're characterizing the pink tide as being associated with a particular pathway to power, but there's another set of cases in Latin America where people also, you know, often think of as being part of the left turn. And, you know, in some of my work, I've argued that, you know, that the distinction between these cases has to do in part with how neoliberalism itself was introduced and how traditional party systems were aligned within that. And let me just step back for a second. I think in some ways, I like thinking in terms of the broader set of cases because it helps us understand that the pushback against neoliberalism in Latin America was broader, but it takes place in different ways. So it gets manifested and channeled politically different in some countries than others. And in some of my work, I've argued that the key difference is whether or not you had You had conservative actors implementing neoliberal reforms and a major party of the left in opposition. And where you had that, the major party of the left in opposition was able to channel the resistance to the neoliberal model, in a sense, within the existing regime institutions and eventually strengthen after neoliberal reforms and come into office. And so that would be the Brazilian case, Uruguay, Chile, mm-hmm. perhaps El Salvador. Whereas the set of cases you're looking at are the cases that in my work I call the bait and switch cases, where traditional populist or center-left parties, often with labor bases, they're actually the ones who take the lead in imposing the neoliberal reforms. And essentially the entire party system converges around the neoliberal model, and you get in those contexts, that's where you get the social backlash or the kinds of popular uprisings that you're talking about, and then the rise of some sort of new, you know, typically more radical kind of leftist alternative. But the question is, is there value in thinking about this broader set of cases for trying to understand, you know, how widespread popular resistance to neoliberalism really was in the region, but how it gets channeled and steered politically in rather different ways. And there's one a final follow-up to this. Is Bolivia the exception that proves the rule? Because I would argue that, I mean, Bolivia, at this point, Bolivia looks, of the cases you're looking at, Bolivia looks more resilient and healthier, and you know, they've performed much better economically, and they're clearly more resilient politically. And I would argue that, in fact, your argument helps us understand that, because in some ways I think they're the exception that proves the rule, because you really did have a strong organizational kernel around which the MAS was built and which creates the leadership of Evo Morales. It wasn't an urban labor movement, it was the Cocalero movement, but it was a union, actually, essentially a peasant union. Though eventually the MAS in Bolivia brings in the urban popular constituencies, the informal sectors, and everybody like you talk about, but I would argue it was the one case where you really did have a very strong organizational kernel, well organized in the social sphere, that then constructs the political party and sponsors the political leadership. And does your argument, in fact, I think your argument helps us understand what makes Bolivia look better than some of the other cases. In fact, I think your argument also helps us understand some of these other cases, the broader set of cases like Brazil and Chile and Uruguay, that I mentioned before. In fact, I'm writing a piece now that sort of challenges the traditional two left arguments, good lefts, bad lefts, populists versus social democrats, whatever you want to call them. I think you and I would agree that those labels don't help us very much. But when I look at the larger set of cases, I would argue that within both of those two traditional camps, you can identify catastrophes, Venezuela and Brazil, and relative success cases, where I would put Bolivia and Uruguay. And I would argue that both Uruguay and Bolivia are different in part because the parties of the left and the leaderships have remained more tightly grounded in the kinds of organized social constituencies that you're getting at within your book. Uruguay did not go through the neoliberal transformation quite as deeply as other cases in the region. The labor movement hung together more strongly and remained more closely tied to the Frente Amplio than which you certainly, the Chilean case, dramatically different. And even Brazil, where I think the PT really lost a lot of those well-organized social bases. But I think the Uruguayan left has remained more anchored in the organized social bases, and the Bolivian left as well. And I think the ongoing capacity for autonomous popular mobilization in Bolivia is part of what has held the MAS and Evo Morales accountable to, you know, the social basis than which you might have otherwise. Even though clearly there are things you can criticize in Bolivia, and I'm very open to the criticisms of that. But I think compared to the other broader sweep of cases, I think Uruguay and Bolivia, you know, from those two different camps, look strongest and most successful. And I think they are the two cases that are the most deeply rooted in the kinds of, you know, grassroots organizing that you talk about in the paper. So in some, I would argue that your basic structuralist account helps us make sense of those differences.
In a way that I would have missed because I placed Bolivia in that camp. But let me say more about the, starting with the distinction between the pink tide left and the, what's been given all kinds of labels, social democratic, good, right. responsible, non-populist, whatever.
Permissible.
Permissible. Okay, I think we should never call it social democratic. I have nothing social democratic about it from my perspective. But anyway, I actually think those distinctions do help, and they give us purchase on differences that really matter. I mean, I know at the end of your comments you were saying that sometimes they're not that helpful. I've been very much influenced by your work, Kenneth, and when you make these distinctions between like labor-based parties versus elite-oriented parties, right, and how the politics of neoliberalism changes according to those key distinctions. But I mean, again, I do think this distinction really matters in Latin America, and I'll say a little bit about why, especially the difference between the pink tide left and the other left, the left in Chile, right, the Concertación, where the Socialist Party kind of has become the anchor of it, right, the PT in Brazil, right, especially under the Lula heyday years, right. I think the difference is precisely is the following. In the pink tide countries, as you pointed out, two things were happening, right, that were related, obviously. On the one hand, you had these popular uprisings, right? And they were growing in these waves. So Argentina's a great case of this. So the Picaderos started in the mid-90s, right? By 2001, they're invading Buenos Aires, right? And paralyzing the entire country, right? So it's these growing waves of protests that are happening. Bolivia, obviously, it follows the same dynamic for the water war on the one end of it, and then the gas wars on the other end of it, and in between, all kinds of protest activity and intensifying protest activities is going on. That's happening on the one hand. On the other hand, what's happening is that the traditional party system, right, the system of rule, right, the formal system of rule that is trying to manage neoliberalism and the turn to neoliberalism is crumbling, right? And those two things are obviously related, right? But those two, if we can distinguish them analytically, those two factors really matter. And the extent to which there was rising mobilization on one hand, the extent to which the existing party system was crumbling on the other hand, I think the combination of those two factors goes a long way in explaining variation among pink tide countries, right? And so in Bolivia, you might say, right, that both things happen at once, right, at very high levels, and that's given Morales and the MAS, right, more room to maneuver, more durability in power. If anything, because the opposition has not been able to reorganize itself, has not been able to find the constituencies that can really back it and turn it into a ruling option in Bolivia. So that's one thing. But what's happening in the meantime in the non-pink tide countries, the non-pink tide left countries? I would argue that something very different is happening in the 90s and the aughts. What's happening is rather than the ruling system crumbling, it's consolidating itself. Neoliberal democracy coming out of the authoritarian period is actually consolidating itself, and the left is the central player in that consolidation. The Concertación is the party of neoliberal democracy in Chile, is the coalition of neoliberal democracy in Chile. And they consolidate the neoliberal regime following the dictatorship in a way where they very smoothly share power and alternate power, right, after four terms in government with the center-right neoliberals. That's Chile. In Brazil, right, I think this is, we miss this fundamentally, but I think this is the key thing that characterizes the PT. The PT, in one sense, right, following the shaky years of the 90s and the very early 2000s, comes in to really stabilize and consolidate neoliberal democracy in Brazil. And it becomes the anchor party of it, right? With all the everything else, the messiness that characterizes the Brazilian political system, the fragmentation of the party system, the corruption that's built into governance, right? The PT becomes the anchor party in that system, right? So on the one hand, so that's the big distinction. While the pink tide is actually coming in and seriously reorganizing neoliberalism, right? The left, the quote-unquote good left, social democrat, whatever, in these other countries, and I would include the Frente Amplio in Uruguay, I would probably even include, even though it's quite different, the PRD in Mexico, right? When Mexico is coming out of the single party PRI regime, right? It's transitioning to a more formal democracy, right? The PRD plays an important role. It's not the central party that consolidates this new post-PRI regime, right? But it's a pillar of it, in my opinion, right? And so that difference, I think, really matters. It matters in terms of what kind of reforms are actually placed on the agenda, right? It matters in terms of how the political parties in power themselves relate to popular organization and popular mobilization. In Brazil and in Chile, right, the whole point of the PT and the Concertación was to demobilize. Well, he wrote a great book about this, about Chile, right, was to demobilize the former constituencies of the classical left, to eviscerate them in terms of their structural position and power in many respects, right? Now, so that matters both in terms of the dynamics that's going on, right, in the pink tide and the policies that they are toying with, right? But this is where I think it really starts to matter today. Today, I think what's happening in Latin America is it's not just that there's a rise of a new authoritarian right that's threatening, right, democracy in Latin America. What we're experiencing in Latin America today is the second big crisis of neoliberalism. And that second systemic crisis of neoliberalism in Latin America today is going to play itself out quite differently in former pink tide countries, right, or still current pink tide countries like Bolivia, than it will in these other countries like Chile, like Brazil, like Uruguay, and definitely like Mexico. And so you look at what's happening in Mexico and Brazil today, it looks like this divergence, right? I think it's an expression of what's happening in those non-pink tide countries during the second big crisis of neoliberalism.